It is high school prom season, and prom is not what it used to be. Liz Rappaport reporting in today's Wall Street Journal, you don't have to have a date to go to prom at West High School in Salt Lake City. You don't even have to wear a gown or a tuxedo. The event can cost all of $30 a student, including gas money, and maybe your dad does the photo shoot. No one cares, says 18-year-old Anna Boys, a West High School senior. It's good not to care sometime. That's a quote. With preparations for prom at full throttle in many households, some high schools and even some businesses are stepping in to tone down the hype of the prom, ease the pressure, and help manage spending. It's good not to care sometimes. An 18-year-old said that. That's going to ring in my ear for the rest of the day. It's Current State here on WKAR. Welcome to our program, and thank you for being here. The historic Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island is again the site of Michigan's largest business and politics mixer. The annual Mackinac Policy Conference draws hundreds of business leaders and politicians to the island for a three-day strategy summit. This year, the Flint water crisis, the plight of the Detroit public schools, and proposed transportation improvements top the agenda. Rick Pluta is State House Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. He's covered the Mackinac Policy Conference for many years and is on the island this week. I spoke with Rick yesterday as the first full day was wrapping up, and I started out by asking him how Governor Rick Snyder formally welcomed the attendees.
He tried to strike a positive tone in the face of various crises, but most specifically the Flint water crisis. And this was also done under the shadow of a new Detroit News public opinion survey that showed that his popularity is at an all-time low. And so the governor announced to this group of business people, a very, very sympathetic crowd, reports of my demise are well overblown. And he's basically trying to say that just because, you know, we face these big challenges, that they should be approached with optimism rather than what he complained about, especially in the media, you know, pessimism. And he even called a lot of reporters a bunch of Eeyores. And so that was the tone of his welcoming speech, that he said that, you know, Michigan ought to be optimistic about the future, even in the face of crises like the Flint water debacle.
What kind of response did that line get about his demise?
This is a Snyder crowd, and so they ate it up with a spoon, that they were happy. The question is, how is this going to play off the island, where maybe people aren't quite so optimistic and sanguine about the problems that are facing Michigan in a lot of its urban centers, and especially in Flint?
Let's get off the island just for a second, and let me point out the governor's harshest critics have said all along they'd like him to resign. Do you think those critics are warming up to the possibility that he won't?
I don't think they're warming up to the possibility that he won't, but it's very, very unlikely that they're going to get their wish, and they will use the words and the tone that he struck on the island yesterday is more evidence that this is a chief executive who's out of touch, but they're not going to get their wish, at least no time soon.
Did the governor speak to the Detroit public school funding measures?
No, he did not. He did not speak to it, although certainly a lot of attention on the island is focused on what is happening in Lansing regarding the public school system in Detroit. And it looks like Republicans are trying to put together a new deal that would largely eviscerate the authority of a commission that was supposed to control the placement of new schools in the city and to deal with the issue that there are some parts of the city where there are lots of schools, but there are other parts of the city where there are virtually no schools and nothing really for the children who are living near there, who need to attend classes someplace nearby because of all the transportation issues they're facing.
Now, members of the Michigan House are not on the island here this week. They stayed here in Lansing to vote on the DPS plans. How close is the legislature to sealing a deal here?
The word is that they are very close, but the problem with very close is very often bridging that final measure is the most difficult part. And so we will see if the House can get something done in time for Speaker Kevin Cotter to release the members so that they can come and spend at least Thursday night on the island.
This proposal involving the Detroit Education Commission, I'm curious what kind of talk that has generated up there.
You know what, this is a group of people, as a matter of fact, the Detroit Regional Chamber had been hoping to use this event, as they often use this particular event, which is to lobby policymakers for their agenda. And the Detroit Regional Chamber is firmly behind the proposal that's already been adopted by the Senate with the support of Republicans, with the support of Democrats, with the support of Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, and with the support of Governor Snyder. And what they're saying is that this is not enough money, it's too punitive on the teachers' unions, and it doesn't have that critical control over where schools can be opened in the city.
We're talking about the Detroit Regional Chamber's Mackinac Policy Conference. Rick Pluta covers the event each year. Rick is State House Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Can you update us on the status of the energy legislation that we've been waiting for? Where is that?
It's been voted out of committee, and right now it is on the Senate floor, but they're having a lot of trouble drumming up the support necessary to move it. And even while senators, both Republicans and Democrats, are trying to digest all the different parts of it, there are lots of groups from across the political spectrum that are trying to kill it because of some objection or another. On the environmental side, they object the fact that there's no more renewable energy mandate that's in it. It doesn't even maintain the current one. It simply sets a goal. On the far right side of the spectrum, groups like Americans for Prosperity and the Michigan Freedom Fund are trying to kill it because it essentially eliminates the electric choice program by requiring any energy provider in the state to have a significant presence in the state than simply being a pass-through entity. And they're saying that that would essentially kill competition with big utilities by alternative energy providers.
Can the two sides come together on this?
Well, they haven't as of yet, but, you know, this is, it's very big, it's very complex, and there's a lot of room to move the pieces around. The question is, can they be moved close enough together in order to succeed in winning Lansing Math, which is 56 votes to get a majority in the House, 19 votes to get a majority in the Senate, and the support of Governor Rick Snyder.
We're talking about the Detroit Regional Chamber's Mackinac Policy Conference and events unfolding at the Capitol. Rick Pluta covers the event each year. Rick is, of course, State House Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. The Regional Transit Authority of Southeast Michigan has unveiled a plan to provide more bus and rail connections between Detroit and Ann Arbor, also more direct access to a DTW. It's a $4.6 billion plan. RTA wants to put a millage proposal on the November 8th ballot to pay for it. How is that proposal playing at the conference?
Oh, this conference has always been four square behind a regional mass transit system for Metro Detroit and much of Lower Michigan. For decades, they've been trying to get something on this. I mean, I remember this discussion going back to the Engler administration up here and trying to come up with memorandums of understanding and other mechanisms to try and get this rolling. This is as close as they've ever gotten. And so what they're doing is they're launching basically the campaign in support of the ballot drive to get this millage adopted in Southeast Michigan and to get things rolling on that regional mass transit system. And it's a very big, very ambitious project.
I know there's talk of mobility. There's been a broader discussion here about the future of mobility, and that is apparently coming up at the island. What can you tell us?
Sure. I mean, look, this is, you know, by and large, a business conference of business people. And so this group is focused on the economic future of the state and you can't talk about that without talking about the automotive industry. And a lot of people believe that the future of the automotive industry is in things like driverless cars that will come and get you when they are summoned, you know, the next generation taxi cabs. But these things, I mean, they'll have to be able to, you know, read traffic signals, know where other vehicles are on the road in order to avoid them. And Governor Snyder and U.S. Senator Gary Peters and a group of transportation and business people said that Michigan is going to go full throttle to try and compete with Silicon Valley to be the center of that particular industry, with test driving sites, with R&D facilities, and with a road system that's actually equipped to work with those cars, so they can be developed here, they can be tested here, and basically, you know, this could be sort of a connoisseur's paradise for driverless vehicles.
An upcoming session is on Michigan's defense assets. I know Senator Debbie Stabenow is one of the panelists. What can you tell us about that topic?
This is actually an idea that dates back to the Granholm administration, and it's that Michigan can be a center of homeland defense technology and research, that we have a couple of corridors in southeast Michigan and in northern Michigan that could actually serve as homeland defense corridors. That's what they're talked about. And so it includes military bases, research and development facilities, manufacturing facilities. And the idea is basically to, you know, find some of Michigan's strengths in both the military presence here and the manufacturing and the R&D presence here, and use that to leverage the growth of that as an industry here.
You've got hundreds of influential people up there rubbing shoulders all at the same time, like every year. How important can casual conversations be in a setting like that, Rick?
Well, you know, when it comes to deal making, the two things that Mackinac provides are a clubby, chummy atmosphere, maybe lubricated by a cocktail or two and some cold shrimp. But also that when discussions break apart, people are still physically, geographically close together. So people can separate, cool off, think about things. And to reconvene a group to talk about something doesn't really take much more than 10 minutes if you really want it to happen. That's one of the reasons why the Detroit Regional Chamber was so anxious to have House members up here, in order to, you know, have those sorts of discussions and being able to, you know, come together and then come together again to try and reach an accord.
Rick Pluta, State Capitol Bureau Chief from Mackinac Island and the Mackinac Policy Conference from the Detroit Regional Chamber. Thank you, Rick.
Always a pleasure, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, it's not uncommon that fraudulent companies send notices to Michigan property owners trying to get them to pay dearly for property deeds. Those deeds are available from county officials for $1 per page. A new law will crack down on the practice. We'll learn more from Ingham County Register of Deeds, Derek Quinney. That and more coming up on Current State. Well, for those of you uncertain about what today has in store, consider the job of a futurist. Our next guest helps organizations develop a vision extending a decade into the future. Brian David Johnson views himself as a future caster, helping to shape an actionable vision of tomorrow. Mr. Johnson's the futurist in residence at Arizona State University's Center for Science and the Imagination. This week, he's talking with state leaders about Michigan's future at the Mackinac Policy Conference. Anticipating this moment, which for all recorded time has been in the future, I spoke yesterday with Brian David Johnson. I first asked what factors shape an actionable vision of tomorrow.
Well, the work that I do is called future casting, and it is a mix of social science research, of technical investigations, economics. We do some work with trend forecasters as well as a little bit of cultural history. And we mix that in with some work where we do global interviews, where we go around and we interview people about these futures. And we even use a little science fiction to actually model what it will feel like to be a human and live in the future. But I think one of the most important things to remember is that we also ask people, based upon all these inputs, what is the future that you want? And also, what is the future that you want to avoid? Because from those two standpoints, we can turn around and look backwards and say, okay, what are the steps that we need to take today, tomorrow, 5 years from now to get to that future we want and avoid that future we don't want?
Let's go from the what to the how, though, here. It seems that one of the really challenging aspects of future casting, developing these actionable visions of the future, is to navigate all the changes coming at us in the present. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking 10 years into the future. Are you kidding me? How do you take the rapidly unfolding now and create any kind of dependable vision of the future? How do you do that?
Basically, what I tell my students is that it's my job as a futurist to live on the other side of that exponential curve, to live 10 years in the future and have an understanding of where things could go and where we want them to go, and then get prepared for it. And in future casting, part of it is that when you do this modeling, you have to accept, once you've done it, that it's 100% true. But the other thing that you have to accept with 100% certainty is that it will change. Is that really what future casting is a framework to take in all of this disparate information, to process it, to come up with these actionable visions, and then once something new comes in, now you've got a framework to understand it. So it kind of is a mix, and one of the things that future casting does is it embraces uncertainty. One of the things that I like to say is that, you know, uncertainty is the landscape of innovation. It's from that uncertainty. And using the framework and using this approach gives you a way to process new events, new innovations, new changes when they happen.
I know a lot of people feel like they're immersed in the present and in the working world. I think this often means putting out fires. You're not really sculpting any kind of future. You just feel like you're correcting the present. How can people let that go?
I think often people need to give themselves the time and the permission. When I work with companies, when I work with different schools or different areas in the public sector, to take the moment and to think forward, to say, what is that future that I want? What is that future I want to avoid? And imagine it. Because nothing great was ever built by people that wasn't imagined first. And we have to embrace the fact that we will all build our own future. The future is built by people every day. We all are going to build our future. And we have to accept that first and foremost and say, okay, what do I want to do? What do I want for the future of myself, for my family, my community, my church, my town, my state, you name it. And the only way that you can start taking back that control is to first take a moment, give yourself some room, and start asking those questions. Because oftentimes when I ask them, whether it be an average person at a town hall or the CEO of a large company, and I ask that question, what's the future that you want and what's the future that you will want to avoid in 10 years, oftentimes people don't have an answer. And that's really that first step, is to be able to answer that. And once you can start to create that, then you can start to get into those next steps and give you a way to really navigate through some of the challenges that sort of come at us on a daily basis.
I'm talking with futurist Brian David Johnson, who is visiting Michigan and is a speaker at the Mackinac Policy Conference. In your Detroit News piece, you seem quite adamant about not being passive about the future, not just letting it happen, but actively shaping it. My question is this. Broadly, do you think Americans believe that we can shape our future, or do you hear more pessimism on that front?
It's a really interesting time in America. I'm doing a project right now called What's the Future of the American Dream, where I'm going around and holding town halls and doing future casting research on thinking about the future of the American Dream. Now, it's nonpartisan. It sort of, it says that the future involves all of us. We are at our best when we don't agree with each other. But it really goes out and asks that question, because I found myself asking it about 6 to 8 months ago, and people didn't have an opinion. They actually didn't have a vision for the future of themselves and for the future of the country. And that really bothered me, again, is that you really need to have that vision to start building it. But the more I talk to people and the more I say to them, well, tell me what your vision is, and they begin to talk about it, sometimes it'll be negative, sometimes it'll be worrisome, but I do believe that inherent in our DNA, and this is no more apparent than when you talk to people outside of the U.S., is that there is an optimism in America. There's an optimism for being able to shape the future, being able to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, to be able to do the work. And even though we might have some adversities and challenges, the more I would talk with people, typically that optimism would come out.
I'm reminded of a line from your news piece as well. You also wrote, quote, "Over the past two decades as a futurist, I've learned that the way we change the future is to change the story people tell themselves about the future they will live in." So you seem to be suggesting that collectively, we, humanity, does have a vision of the future?
We have to. Human beings are story-believing machines. That's what our brains do. I have lots of work with neuroscientists that's actually how we communicate. It's how we empathize and sympathize, is we actually use story as a way to talk about maybe what happened in your day, again, or maybe even what your hopes are for yourself and your kids and the country. That it's actually stories that capture that and that really inspire us. And that's why I honed in on the American dream, because there's no greater story. There's no greater story that has inspired people to come to the shores, that has driven people to work harder, to be able to dream bigger, that those stories are the things that fuel us.
Policymakers and other officials are always trying to optimize our economic futures. And here in Michigan, there's been a much publicized effort to reinvent the state, to rely less on manufacturing, particularly automobile manufacturing, and to diversify the economy. You must deal with this constantly, I imagine. What advice can you offer to a state like ours that's aiming at some degree of reinvention?
It goes back to that story notion. And that's one of the reasons why I'm here at the Mackinac Policy Conference, is to have those conversations, to sit down with both the public and private leaders and actually do a future casting on the future of Michigan and what's possible. And I think first it's understanding the facts, understanding the social science, understanding what's going to be possible from a technology standpoint, and all those different inputs, and then looking at them and starting to say, okay, when we put all of these things together, what does that mean for the future of Michigan? Certainly, Michigan has an incredible legacy of manufacturing, but it also has an incredible legacy of design. It also has a really interesting biomedical background. So there's a lot of things, I think, that are going for the state that can really start to fuel what is that dream. What is that new story? And part of why that story is so important, because it starts to inspire the next generation. That's one of the things I spend so much of my time doing, is going out and teaching, going out and spending time with that next generation to inspire them. And that's one of the things that I will be talking about here, is how can you inspire the next generation to stay in Michigan, and how can you attract the next generation to come to Michigan and work, and not only of workers in the labor force, but also for investment, also for attention. That I think there's an incredible infrastructure here that's in place, and so much is kind of untapped. But it also should be said that Michigan, and specifically what's happened in some areas, you know, things like Detroit, and there's some areas where it really has come back. That if you look just, you know, 8 years ago to where we are today, and I'm not saying everything is great, because no, there's still plenty of work to do, but oftentimes I try to tell folks in Michigan that you should give yourselves a little credit. You've actually had some visions, and you've pushed really hard and made some changes. And certainly there's more work to do, but you've shown collectively that it can be done.
Futurist Brian David Johnson, who is visiting Michigan here this week and speaking at the Mackinac Policy Conference, formerly of Intel, currently of Arizona State University. Mr. Johnson, thank you so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Coming up on Current State, this weekend we'll be able to explore dueling banjo styles, learn about bluegrass and old-time playing at the 12th Annual Midwest Banjo Camp with co-director Stan Werben. We will learn more coming up after the break on... Doug Maines there on guitar, backed up by Josh Michaels on the cello. They're part of Doug Maines and the City Folk, and they performed for us a little over a month ago here in Studio S. Tomorrow, we welcome the Appleseed Collective. Bluegrass and Irish folk songs are part of their repertoire. The Appleseed Collective, tomorrow on a Live Music Friday here on Current State from WKAR. We hope you can join us for that. Michigan property owners should be aware of a change in state law coming next month. It's not uncommon that fraudulent companies send notices to property owners trying to get them to pay close to $100 in some cases for property deeds. Those same deeds are available from our next guest for a dollar per page. Governor Snyder recently signed into law a measure that will crack down on that practice. Here to explain, Ingham County Register of Deeds, Derek Quinney. Welcome to Current State, Derek.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Good to see you. How does this scheme typically work then?
Well, for years, what had been happening, there were organizations that were submitting official-looking documents to, and they had a specific targeted audience that they were going to, primarily seniors, where they would send these specific documents indicating that if you did not have a record of your deed or you did not have a hard copy of your deed in your hand, that they would go ahead and get this for you. They charge an absorbent fee of $83, $89 for that particular fee. And we were having individuals come into our office in a panic, just fearful of the fact that they did not have a copy of their deed, which one is not required to have. We have that is all public information in which you can look up on our website, and you can also come in the office to get that information. What was happening is these individuals were sending out these notices. You called it fraud, and you call it those things. I've been told that I can't say that because of the disclaimer that's on the document. I can say that it's unethical, though. So what was happening is they were charging these fees. Individuals were paying these amounts, and all the time, the information was available right here in our office at a dollar a page.
Yeah.
The bill that went into place, Public Act 79, in which Governor Snyder signed last month, was introduced by former Register Curtis Hertel. We want to thank Curtis for all the work that he's done and continuing to provide outreach and look out for the residents of Ingham County. And what it does now is it's more transparent. These companies now have to first submit a 15-day notice. They have to give us a 15-day notice that they are, in fact, mailing out this particular notice. Secondly, they can charge no more than $4 for the price of what it costs in our office.
So they can still conduct the practice, but the prices have got to come down, and they've got to make everybody aware that they're doing.
They got to raise awareness about it to us here at the Register's office, so that we'll know. And also, the price has been dramatically reduced from what it was before.
Well, they can still operate then.
They can still operate, but the incentive has certainly been reduced. Where it's, you figure a dollar a page now, so they can charge no more than $4, meaning that for $4 a page, generally two pages is all that's required to get your document. So for $8, I don't think that the cost and the effort is something that they're willing to invest
you're,
in.
You're disincentivizing this activity.
That's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is.
Would you like to see the practice ended altogether? Do you think this might end the practice altogether?
We're certainly hoping, we're optimistic that it's currently going to end the practice altogether. Simply because, as I said, when they initially you had an opportunity to make an $80 profit on this deal, now you go down to $4 a profit. The incentive for doing that has been reduced dramatically.
How are property owners contacted typically? Is this a phone scam or is it a, I won't say scam, I guess.
You can say those things. I can't.
the county attorneys are listening
as we speak. Absolutely.
Is it a mail thing or a phone call thing?
It is by mail that they send the document out, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
How common has this been?
Well, in the year and a half that I've been in the office, I've had mailings occur. We've had folks come in at least three times since I've done this, where there's three rounds of mailing, and they're different companies too. There's one in East Lansing, there's one in Okemos, and then there's one out of California also, and each one of those send those, circulate them out.
Now, your website details a fraud alert system that residents can sign up for? How does that work?
Fraud Alert is a program that we offer, which provides you information when there's any activity that is going on regarding a specific piece of property that you own. What you do is you take the time, you go to our website, enter into your name, and be very specific about your name when you enter it in. For example, the more common names like John Smith, for example, if there's a middle initial or the spelling of your name, if you can be more as detailed as possible with that, because the more common names, John Smith, for example, a million John Smiths could jump up on there. So the more specific you are with that, what it does is anytime there's activity relates to your specific piece of property, you get an alert either on your computer or by phone, whichever way you choose to do that. And it's a service that we offer through the county register's office absolutely free, other than you taking the time to go ahead and fill it out or submit your information.
Ingham County Register of Deeds, Derek Quinney is our guest here on WKAR's Current State. What is the one service that your office offers to county residents that you think more county residents really most ought to be aware of?
Well, first off, the accuracy, the timeliness and the accuracy of the documents in which you provide. First off, you're not legally required to do this, but we encourage you to do that simply because institutions such as title companies, banks, mortgage companies, attorneys are all going to reference the information that is in our office or recorded in our office to assure that any loans or any opportunities for financing of these documents and so forth is accurate and it's filed in our office. So yeah, that's the one service that we provide.
So a lot of institutions rely on the data that's in the details of the data that's in your office for their documents.
Excellent.
So if it isn't right at the Register of Deeds office, it's not going to be right in a bunch of other places.
That's exactly right. Title companies are not going to honor or recognize those things if they're not accurate and filed in our office.
I think it's fair to say a lot of county residents don't have a great grasp of what your office does. Describe the meat and potatoes of your job as a Register of Deeds.
I'd love to do that. In fact, I'm glad that you asked that, simply because that was one of the things that I found to be a real awakening for me when I first got there. But what we do at the Register of Deeds office, obviously, is we register or file deeds. But the office is the official repository of documents relating to real property in the county. We provide all this service to the residents and for various types of documents that they file, be it quitclaim deeds, be it warranty deeds, land contracts, all of those things are filed in our office, and we are the official repository, as I mentioned earlier. We retain those records permanently. They are filed in our office. We have records dating back to 1837. It's pretty cool to come in our office. I'd like to invite you and others to come out to see exactly what we have there. Mm-hmm. The documents or the books, what we call libers, are referenced there. And back in the day when they used quill pens and ink wells to fill all these things out, it's a pretty interesting stuff. We since then digitized that information, but we're required to keep that on a permanent basis forever as in our offices. We were the first constitution is what recognized the Register of Deeds office as official for holding these records and such.
You spent years with the AFL-CIO in Lansing, and you spent 9 years on the Lansing City Council. What's the transition to this job been like for you?
Well, it's been a real education for me, but I certainly am enjoying this. I was fortunate enough to inherit a great staff and a deputy that's just been absolutely fantastic to help bring me up to speed on this. I had a little awareness of what the office entailed, though, as a result of myself being involved in land transactions and so forth, that my residents, my parents, land that they owned after my mom passed away, my siblings and I had to go through the process of the successions and requiring the filing of the deeds and documents to attain the property that we have now in Louisiana.
You missed the city council? Ever missed the city council? You spent 9 years on it.
Well, you know, the city council was good to me. There was some great times there, and I certainly, being a lifelong resident here in the city of Lansing, it was certainly a joy to represent the residents in the city of Lansing. But it was time to move on. Opportunity presented itself. Public service is something that I truly enjoy doing, and this was another opportunity to learn, grow, and serve the public in another capacity.
Great to see Derek Quinney again. Derek is Ingham County's Register of Deeds. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us here, Mark. Sure. We appreciate it.
Current State's latest pop-up stories event was at the Robin Theater in Lansing last week. The theme was the birds and the bees. Storyteller Deidrea Humphreys-Barker took a literal interpretation of the theme and shared this story from her childhood.
So I grew up in a gender-segregated household. There were the girls' room, bedroom, and the boys' bedroom. There was girls' work, and there was boys' work. Now, this is illegal today, but this is the way that most baby boomers grew up. I was very envious of my brothers because the boys' work was outside of the house and the girls' work was inside of the house. The boys' work, well, I was envious mostly of my younger brother, Andy. He was 1 year younger than me, but he got to go outside and stay outside. So in the summer, he got to go outside and mow the grass, and our house had a front yard, a side yard, and a backyard. And when he had mowed that, his work was done. But inside the house, there was plenty of work. The work never ended, especially for a family of 15 like I grew up in. There were 13 kids. So girls' work was wash the dishes, dry the dishes, put the dishes away, help wash the clothes, hang up the clothes, iron the clothes, put the clothes away, help with the cooking, clean up the bathroom, the kitchen, the bedrooms, vacuum, dust, and we got to babysit as well. So the work was never ending. So I was very jealous of my brothers, so I tried to get outside and play with them as much as I could. So one day, we are outside, and I'm with my brother Andy and two boys on the block, Dwight and David Haygood. Now, their mother was very strict with them. And when she called for them, they had to go and run home right quick. So this day, we're outside, and they're going to catch something. I know it because they have a jar, a glass jar, and the metal lid has holes punched in it. Those are the air holes. They're going to get something. So we're standing by the fence in the yard where the hollyhocks grow. Now, the hollyhocks, if you're not familiar with that flower, it's a stalk, and it grows 5-6 feet tall. And the flowers grow out of the stalk like a teacup hanging on the side. And bees like it because it has a big stamen with lots of pollen in it. So we're standing there. Dwight has the jar that they're going to catch something in, and he puts it up against a flower and clamps the lid on. Now he's got this pink flower in the jar, and this angry bee comes buzzing out. It's a bumblebee. It's a bumblebee. And it immediately flies up to the lid where there's air coming in, but it can't get out. It's trapped. And then it bounces off the clear glass wall, and then it can't get out there, and it bounces off the other one, and it is angry. And so I am fascinated because, you know, I never get to see this stuff up close. So I'm looking at the bee, and it is a beautiful bee. It's a great big bee, as big as my first digit on my thumb. Is covered with all this black velvet. It has these gossamer wings that are beating so fast, I can't even see the wings. And it's got this stinger out the back of its body. And it's just going crazy in there trying to get out, but it can't. And so we watch this for a while, and I'm watching it. And then all of a sudden, there's this voice. Dwight, David. It's the Haygoods' mother. And Dwight says, I gotta go. And without any warning, he unscrews the top He unscrews the top, and this bee, it kind of gets, you know, a little disoriented, but man, it comes out, it ricochets out, and it stings me. And I am screaming and crying. It hurts so bad. It hurts even worse than when I had to have my foot cut open because I had an infection. They had to drain it. So I'm running home and screaming and crying. I get there and I slam the door behind me so nature can stay out there. And my mother, she applies, you know, calamine lotion to my swollen arm, and I sit on the porch for a week. So I tell you all that to say that when the director Woody Allen says that he is at two with nature, I say, me too.
Deidrea Humphrey Barker's there telling her story about bees. More great first-person truth storytelling at our next event, Wednesday, June 29th at the Allen Marketplace. The theme will be Putting Down Roots. Putting Down Roots. Wednesday the 29th, Allen Marketplace. Plan to join us, please, in either a listening or storytelling mode. For information, go to our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. Whether you like either bluegrass or clawhammer styles, this weekend the Midwest Banjo Camp strums its way to Olivet College. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with Stan Werben, co-director of the camp, who's also the owner of the Old Town Lansing landmark that is Elderly Instruments, and Stan certainly knows both of those two banjo styles.
You know, our main two things are clawhammer banjo, which is an old-time downpicking style, and bluegrass banjo, which is a three-finger style where you pick up with two fingers and down with your thumb. And that's a style that was really first developed in the middle to late 1940s. And there are a lot of variants on that, and there's been a lot of creative changes to that style. So there's sort of modern bluegrass, and there's older bluegrass. And but it's all really great playing and really sounds great if you like that kind of thing. So what we have, we get about 20 faculty altogether, 20 or 22 maybe, and there's almost 20 faculty who teach banjo, but then we have four or five other people who teach various other instruments like fiddle, bass, guitar, and mandolin, and a little bit of dobro this year.
In addition to the instructions that are going to be happening, there's plenty of jam sessions that also happen.
Yes. So the jam sessions, we have several different kinds of jam sessions, some of which, many of which are, every night there are formal jam sessions that are led by by members of the staff. So you've got these, again, highly accomplished bluegrass and old time and sometimes other musicians who have been in many jam sessions in their life, and they understand what they should be like, but they also know what level we've told them. You know, is this an advanced jam session? Is this an intermediate jam session? Is this a lower intermediate jam session? Is it a novice jam session? The difference is the speed. The novice jam sessions go very slowly, but that's because novices can't handle an up-to-speed musical jam session. And that's how you get there, though, is you start slow and you can work into it. The other thing that we do is, you know, we do have people playing most of the usable instruments that we need for jam sessions, but we also bring in some other people from the community who we call musos, which is to say they're musicians who are coming in because actually, and honestly, we're not paying them. We'll feed and house them, but we don't pay them. But they're having a good time, and they help. They're people who like to be at a jam session at maybe certain levels themselves, but they know that their job is to help out, because it's really, the whole thing is as a teaching experience for the students. First year we had, I think, about 140, 150 attendees. And this year we're going to have something over 250. And that's been pretty steady the last 3 years.
Are you keeping track of people that have come to every single one?
Oh yes, when you register, you tell it. We ask, you know, which ones have you been to? And there are a few people who have been to every single one. There are a lot of people who have been to a lot of them, and but you know, naturally, not everybody comes back. It's not everybody's cup of tea, or maybe they learned everything they needed to learn. We hope. So yeah, but we kind of keep track of that.
We're speaking with Stan Werben, owner of Elderly Instruments in Lansing, as well as co-director of the Midwest Banjo Camp taking place this weekend in Olivet, Michigan. This is the 12th year of the Midwest Banjo Camp, so Stan, what have you learned about putting this on over the past dozen years or so?
You know, when you start an enterprise, and this is sort of was an enterprise, and I'm doing it, I do it with a partner whose name is Ken Perlman, who's actually quite a very well-known exponent of the Clawhammer Banjo. Ken had been involved in setting up some other camps, and he and I were talking. Ken lives in Massachusetts, and he and I were talking, and I said, you know, you're doing these other banjo camps. It'd sure be cool if you did a banjo camp out this way. We'd love to have it. I think there are a lot of people who would love to go to it. And he said, oh, well, let's talk. And so we talked, and this was, well, probably 13 years ago, and before you knew it, he had convinced me to be sort of the local liaison for it, because he feels like he needs somebody who lives near where the camp is going to be, and I wanted it to be here, of course. So we started off the first year. We did it at Michigan State University, and we got a good response, and we had a pretty good time, and we didn't lose money. And, well, it's always, you know, it's a good thing. And so then we continued on. We did it for two more years at MSU, and then we found more of a kind of a more permanent home that worked a little better for us down at Olivet College, which is about 35 miles south of here.
Are there children, so to speak, of banjo camp where students have gotten together and formed their own bands that are going in existence?
Yes. I mean, we have students from all over the country who come here. But we have particularly large groups of people from Midwestern states. We have, you know, a lot of people from Michigan. We have a whole bunch from Ohio. We have a pretty good number from Indiana. But then it gets to be a bigger number from Illinois. And we do pretty well with like Wisconsin and Minnesota too. But then we have people from Florida, we have people coming from Germany this year. So people come from all over, and certainly we have some people from California and Arizona and New Mexico. So they come from all over. But those states that where there are, you know, pretty good numbers coming, where there might be, say, 20 or more people from that state coming, a number of times I've been told that people are making friends there. They come back and meet their old friends there again. But then there's other groups of people who you know, like a bunch of people I know some years ago, came down from Minnesota, but they didn't know each other. They didn't all know each other. And some of them have formed, I think, you know, I don't know that they perform professional bands, but they've formed informal kind of fun bands, you know. So.
Is there a base level of instruction that people have to have in order to just attend, or is this a kind of open invite?
Well, it's an open invite, but for banjo, we teach four different levels for each type of the two main kinds of playing, the bluegrass and the clawhammer. And so you can actually be a novice, and you can start from scratch, although we think you'll do better if you spend at least a few weeks or maybe a few months kind of getting yourself started before you come here, and then take the novice track. But everything that the novice needs to know will be taught here. And it might be hard to get through it all in 3 days as a absolute beginner who's never touched a banjo before.
We've been speaking with Stan Werben, owner of Elderly Instruments and co-director of the Midwest Banjo Camp taking place this weekend at Olivet College. You can learn more about attending the Banjo Camp either for the full Thursday to Sunday experience or just for the weekend over at MidwestBanjoCamp.com. Stan, thanks for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, the Capital Area Transportation Authority wants to convert Route 1 on the Michigan Avenue Grand River Corridor into a bus rapid transit line. Supporters and opponents are holding firm on each side. Earlier this week, we spoke with a supporter, CATA's Deb Alexander. Tomorrow, we'll hear from an Okemos business owner who opposes the idea. Plus, it's a live music Friday here in Studio S. We welcome the Appleseed Collective. The band specializes in bluegrass and Celtic folk music. We'll rosin up the Irish fiddle tomorrow on the Appleseed with the Appleseed Collective. Don't forget, WKAR programming is different and better in part due to you, in large part due to you. Help us continue to bring extraordinary programs like Current State to you and your community. Use the Give Now button at WKAR.org. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable, and available anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Connect with us on social media. Find us on Twitter at KAR Current State. On Facebook, we're at Current State from WKAR. Hope you can join us on Live Music Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a good day.